So we're standing in Amy Silman's Directions Gallery, and we're looking at a wall of her drawings of couples. And I thought we'd just start with this, Amy. Can you discuss a little bit what brought you to make these drawings and the process of the drawings?
These drawings actually are like kind of third, fourth, and fifth generations of drawings away from the original drawings of people that I did. And I think the original impetus was that when I was making my last show for New York at Brunsigma, the figures were all kind of cartoony, and they were all drawn from my head. And I think in the past I've done a whole bunch of portrait drawings, but I had never incorporated those into the basis for paintings. I would draw from life for fun, but I wouldn't draw for sketches for paintings or anything like that.
And you really not exhibited those portraits much.
Yeah, no, only one time, and that was about a decade ago or more. So after doing figuration, kind of Gustin-y figuration, uh-huh. kind of from a cartoonal position for years and years, I felt like that was a little dried up, and that it might be more interesting to really look at the way people do function. And the way that I usually draw people in the older paintings has always been kind of psychological. Mm-hmm. Though they're cartoony, they're supposed to have a kind of pathos or some kind of I would think of it as being kind of a Beckett-like quality mm-hmm. of something kind of absurd or
and those
tragicomic.
Were not specific. You weren't thinking of anyone in particular except maybe yourself in those earlier
Sometimes
figures.
I would. No, I would think of different people. I would definitely think of characters, people that sort of occupied positions that I thought might be, who might occupy a character position. Uh-huh. Like, there was definitely...
Like a type.
Yeah, there was a traveling salesman that I used
right.
to draw, and he was my dad.
Okay, your Willie Loman.
Mm-hmm. And, but anyway, I got to this place where I thought I should look at other people more specifically to build a new vocabulary for form, basically. And not everybody has to be like a head on a stick. So I thought that it would be interesting to look at couples because there's a sort of obvious psychological charge between them. And I thought, okay, here's instant content, you know,
and
the way they sit around.
It's not just the figure or the body, it's how those two bodies relate.
Yeah, totally. So it's kind of the way they sit around, the way they lean on each other, what they do. I didn't even tell them what to do. I would just say, I'd like to come and draw you. And they would do all kinds of things. Literally, some would lay in bed. Some got naked. Many just sat on chairs and read.
And they just sort of did what they do when they're hanging around their apartment.
Well, they didn't. That was the thing that was really funny.
I mean, some look more posed.
Yes, yeah, some. I didn't pose anybody.
Some look completely casual.
Yeah, I mean, some assumed this position of like funerary statues, and others got cozy.
Uh-huh.
You know, but in all cases, I didn't tell them what to do, and I didn't instruct them in any way. Although I did say, please don't take your clothes off.
Right.
I always said, bring your dog and leave your children out.
So those were the parameters. And how long usually were those life drawing sessions that you would do?
They were about an hour, 90 minutes. I mean, it would take a lot longer.
Like you had to get there and settle in?
Yeah, there'd have to be coffee drinking and
right.
then, you know, visiting, and then there'd have to be sort of shuffling around. Telephones had to go on and off, like
right.
settling, and then usually after about 20 minutes, there'd be one great change, and at that point, they would get into the position that they seemed like they were really going to be in.
And then you would start.
And then I would draw more. I mean, I would draw them for the first 20 minutes, but almost invariably, the first 20 minutes got thrown out.
Uh-huh. And these are all people you know?
Yeah, I just figured that I would draw the people I knew because I would have more easy access to their comfort level.
Mm-hmm.
And I started with... You know, I tried to, you know, start with the people who were, well, I started with those who were available, but I have a list of about 100 more that I haven't gotten
like to
yet.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, it's still going to go on.
And maybe we should also mention that prior to embarking on this, you, in addition to your desire to kind of flesh out the figure a little bit more in your painting, you were doing a number, you had done, I don't know how many, 3 or 4 paintings in which there were 3 figures. This kind of threesome was popping up in the work. And so this work in some way was also your observation of the couples somehow linked to something that was happening in the painting.
Yeah, I kind of realized that was part of the thing about moving away from the cartoonal. In the cartoonal, there were 3 because I was drawing a triangle. Mm-hmm. And in this form, I was the third.
Right.
And it was really clear to me immediately that I became the third. It actually started, well, I talked about it with Ian in the book interview, but it was very specific and literal in that I was originally making studies for a painting of 3 people.
Right.
I drew the original one just to try to get a painting right.
Uh-huh.
Yeah,
mm-hmm.
Yeah. And then I just immediately realized instantly, I'm the third.
Mm-hmm.
And that was perfect. Yeah.
So maybe describe also that. So you have this group of drawings that come from the sessions you do with the couples, and then the next step is the memory drawing. Can you?
Yeah. Then I would just draw. I would try to draw 1 hour. At home, I just wanted to test what my memory could do, and I just tried to redraw them. And then I thought those drawings were very funny because they were kind of distorted. And then the distortions made it really obvious that those drawings from memory were the real meat, because they were the things that were linked to the process of first of all, the obvious process of abstraction, but also the process of draining the boring content away and putting the more interesting content in. I guess making it go from an act of perception to an act of imagination.
Uh-huh, uh-huh. So mm-hmm. It goes from observation in some way.
Yeah.
To something where you're interpreting more.
Right. And all it was basically doing exactly what I've always done, but just doing it in steps.
Uh-huh.
And really enjoying the steps. Yeah.
And so then each generation of drawings, as we've been calling them, is a kind of response, in a way, to the one that preceded it, gradually becoming more abstract.
Yeah, I mean, I kind of think, it's sort of like a short-term version of, what it took, Mondrian, a decade to do. But it's kind of it was just like Campbell's soup, the Lipton soup version, where it's modernist flavor packet, it's just instant
the quick
abstraction
version.
In a classic historical tradition.
Exactly. I mean, that's what,
but I don't mean it in a glib way. I mean, I really do.
No, and this is something that, I mean, the relationship between representation and figuration and abstraction has always been in your work on some level.
Yeah.
This has just kind of pushed it to
more
pronounced.
It just didn't seem sort of, actually, it seemed like to me, once I took time to work through all the steps more slowly, it seemed, on the one hand, it made me feel more incredibly old-fashioned and kind of historical.
Yeah, that you were engaging in this.
Yeah, but it also made me feel incredibly not glib, because I thought that the whole it seems kind of, I don't know, like in hindsight it seems kind of like all of the things before that were too easy.
Mm-hmm.
Like it's so easy to say I'm investigating the space between abstraction and figuration, but if you're not really investigating
mm-hmm.
the space between them, then you're just making a kind of dumb mélange of the
of
two.
Both.
So it sort of made it seem like I was putting my money where my mouth was.
Uh-huh.
Mm-hmm.
But you had finally gotten to something you've been thinking about for a long time.
I'd been saying I was doing
uh-huh.
it, but I kind of felt now really investigate the space between them.
Uh-huh.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the other reason why I would say there's no glibness is that your interest in the subjects and your interest in people is actually quite pronounced. I mean, just from knowing you
uh-huh.
in our many, many conversations, and you're incredible.
I'm just nosy.
Yeah, you're nosy and you're curious and you remember. I mean, we were talking about this yesterday. It's incredible what you remember about people's lives and their biographies and their and what they tell you. And I think that there's a genuineness to your ability and desire to kind of have those connections with people. And I think that I think what's beautiful about the drawings that we have here is that you can see that, even though it's not spelled out in any way. You can see a kind of desire and a kind of comfort and a discomfort and all of this kind of intimacy happening there.
Yeah, you know how it really started? Partly, it was that I told Alexandra Meir that I wanted to be a conceptual artist and that my first project would be that I would go to everyone I knew and sleep with them for one night. And she said, that is a fantastic project.
She was like, I should have done
yeah,
that.
Yeah, you must do that project. You must. And I thought, then I thought about it. I really thought about it because I thought, like, I really do like to get all close to people and see what they're like. And
how far can I push it?
Yeah.
Can I sleep in the same bed?
And she said, I said to her, like, I wanted it to be like the piece that... who's the French woman artist?
Sophie Cal,
but I didn't want to sleep in the bed that they
slept
in.
People.
Yeah, I didn't want to stalk them or go where they weren't. I wanted to go in the bed with them, but not sleep with them, just sleep
right.
in the same bed with them.
Yeah.
And anyway, Alexandra Meir thought this was a fantastic project and she was really encouraging, which I actually appreciated. And then
She's
I thought,
your conceptual art advisor.
My advisor, and then I thought, well, I can't really do that project because it doesn't involve the part that I also like, which is going home, turning off the phone and making something, you know.
Drawing,
these are like
painting.
The caboose. This is what comes after. But
at some level,
I wanted to do that. And yeah, so then I thought, well, I know how I can do it. I'll draw them.
Mm-hmm. That's great. You hadn't told me that before.
Uh-huh.
So let's talk about how the drawings then relate to the paintings. Now we're in the gallery with all the paintings.
Well, then the rest is hard to describe.
Yeah.
Because basically, I don't know what happens. I don't know either. You know.
It seems like the earliest ones, including the one we're looking at right now, which is PNH2 Behemoth.
Mm-hmm.
There was a more direct relationship between a drawing or a group of drawings of a particular couple that you would use as a starting place, a kind of first layer to the painting that eventually gets completely masked over. I mean, we've talked about how I watched PNH in this painting kind of go from being recognizable to subsequent visits to your studio when they just got masked over completely, and now what we're looking at is an absolute abstraction, although I know and you know
although we
the
know,
figures are underneath.
We know that it's a mattress strapped to a top of a car.
Right, and then it starts to look like something else, quite sculptural. And I mean, all of these have connotations to objects, the way that or associations that each individual is going to bring, the way that we do to abstraction. But I think, you know, in the more recent work, certainly in several pieces in this show, you weren't necessarily starting from those specific drawings. It's more like you now have this vocabulary of shape and line and relationship between form and juxtaposition from the couple's mm-hmm. drawings that you're working with. Would you say that that's accurate?
Yeah, I mean, I think that I had a kind of vocabulary
already
mm-hmm. about shape and line and stuff. But I mean, I think I had sort of a modernist vocabulary kind of going for
uh-huh.
a while.
Uh-huh.
But I think that those people, those drawings just gave me a more interesting starting point.
Right.
And then, you know, from there on, it's just about messing up.
Right.
Basically, it's like twirling it upside down and scraping it off and getting into a relationship with the painting. It's basically just moving from being in a relationship with those people to being in a relationship with an oil painting.
Uh-huh.
And my version of a relationship in an oil painting is an extreme process.
Right, so maybe you could talk about that process and the layering and the scraping away and, you know.
Well, this is another, I'm like double-barreled traditionalism because, you know, on the one hand, I'm just looking at people and drawing them and then making abstracter things. And then the other kind is this, I think, very, I would call it time-honored rather than conservative or conventional,
uh-huh.
but it's a time-honored way to paint. That probably derives from Gorky and, you know, painters like that. Maybe not Gorky, because actually Gorky worked on the same forms again and again and again. Uh-huh. But, you know, it's a kind of early modernist way of painting.
That's very rooted in process.
Yeah, to not, you know, have like a clear sense of entirely what the thing's going to look like, uh-huh. and to allow the procedures, material procedures, to kind
come
of
forward.
Build and unbuild. And I think what's the most important thing is this question of unbuilding, uh-huh. and rebuilding, because I think that it's something that people who look at paintings without making paintings don't necessarily know.
Exactly.
Which is how much destruction and ruin goes on underneath, you know, any given painting surface. Mm-hmm. And that's not necessarily the case for all painters, obviously.
But you've talked about that also as where the risk lies somewhat, because you've got something that you have some relationship to and some commitment to, and then you're actually, you know, scraping it off or painting over it, not knowing whether that will further the painting in a direction you want to go or not. Like, there's some risk that you may get rid of something you really like.
Yeah, I mean, you've got to be willing to throw the painting away after spending months supposedly making it.
Right.
You know, or even just have a painting without making it sound like too laborious. There could be a painting that you work on for a week and then you just put it in the corner and then maybe let it sit for a month. But none of these strategies are for working are like very, they're not like
predetermined.
Well, they're not result oriented entirely. You know, if you're supposed to make a show and in the middle you decide, you know, to like scrape everything back and change it, there's some risk in that.
Uh-huh.
I mean, I wouldn't call it like, you know, risk like on a global political scale, but there's a kind of tightrope walk, mm-hmm. that you have to trust the process.
Well, what also came to mind when you were saying this way of working in which the outcome is not known and that you let things come out in the painting through working is also, I think, where the emotional quality of your work rests, because ultimately these abstractions that we're looking at are really charged and they have a lot of emotional bang to them. And I think that that has some relationship to the way that the spaces are awkward, mm-hmm. in some sense. I mean, everything's unbalanced, precarious. There's a vulnerability here that is always and always has been in your work, really, and now is in your work in a different way that's really coming through the formal language of abstraction rather than a particular character or, you know, the cartoony type that you've done in the past. And I think that that's been just incredible to watch, me watching these paintings happen over the last year, 6 months. It's really striking, I think.
Oh, that's good. Well, I mean, that's what I want. I want it to look like it's gonna fall apart.
Right.
And
just building up and falling apart. And
yeah.
Building up.
I mean, I think that would be the thing I would be trying to convey. In a way, in the end, it's kind of fragility.
Right.
You know, or the vulnerability of the thing, of the structure,
uh-huh.
rather than the immensity and the heroism of it.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
Let's talk about color, because I think one thing that our visitors will be struck by immediately walking in the gallery is just your incredible sense of color. And, you know, in part it's a kind of willingness to work with a really diverse palette and put things together that maybe don't quite go together in some conventional way. But how do you think about color in your work? Is it just instinctual?
Yeah. Color's hard to talk about. It is. And I always feel like it's a little bit beyond words. But I realized when we were talking earlier about something else that I understand these paintings as not being a desire to return to the good old days of abstraction or the good old days of anything. Like, it's really important for me to understand these paintings as not a kind of sentimental return. Instead, I kind of feel like I'm trying to work through, destroy, and rebuild the possibility of like finding a kind of meaning conceptually and like philosophically in making something by hand that you don't really understand. So the fact that color is sort of beyond language is really important. The fact that color has taken second place, you know, in the consideration of art, or has been relegated to sort of the position of taste, it's really important to me to reclaim it as like a primary structure, and not to do so with a kind of what I think is like really conservative political agenda of return to the good old days. So I don't want to like make colors that seem entirely tasteful. Right. Like I like the idea of scraping paint up off the floor, using things that are garish, things that seem, if Greg Bordowitz was here, he would say they were queer.
Right.
You know, that they're colors that like really push the envelope and challenge the agenda of just simple, easy, good taste. They should be a little queasy, a little uncomfortable, like kind of beautiful, but like a weird, uncomfortable, awkward beauty,
right,
sort of like the form. And it's really important to me that the color be not just store-bought and slapped on in a kind of fabricating way, but like worked through to a position of emotional discomfort,
right,
slowly.
Do you start, and I don't even know the answer to this already, when you begin a painting, do you have a general palette in mind that probably will get mixed up, or do you just sort of like getting, just doing it, just grabbing colors as you go along?
It's just like, first it's like a shopping frenzy, you know, because there's so many colors in the store. I always wonder about like painters at times before Pearl Paint.
Yeah, what
you
do
know?
They do?
Where did they get
to
their
mix
paints?
All these?
Yeah. And then there's like, then there's the incredible mistakes, you know, like a lot of the colors that are in this show were the globs of paint that I scraped off, you know.
And reused.
Yeah, for a lot of the colors in this show, the way that the paintings resolved, they resolved around one or two of the literal piles on the floor.
I mean,
paint
mixed
was
together.
Just, you know, the paint would just be laying everywhere.
Uh-huh.
There'd be big piles and
globs
and cups and stuff of like bad stuff that was scraped off. And then I would use that to build paintings out of kind of that same kind of ruined color. Mm-hmm. Like these are the sort of ruined structures.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, it's kind of like, that was sort of like a dirty pleasure,
mm-hmm,
you know, to kind of find some really bizarre green that I have never seen before.
Right.
And put it with like some really sparkly orange, or you know, it's just, that's just, you know, that's like,
that's fun.
That's just like taste, that's just fun.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Do you want to talk about they're small, we call them, I forget, we had all these like the small medium size panels, because you've been painting in different size canvases, and we stuck with two,
little and big,
and in the case of the show there's actually about four different.
Well, there's medium.
With.
Yeah, there's one size a little bit bigger, but.
And then there were a couple of early ones, like P&H, the first one, that were slightly smaller than what we've got here.
Yeah, there was, right, there was big, little, and little, big.
Right.
But those ones, excuse me, I think we just chose these. I don't
want
know.
It to be,
well,
too.
I think that the ones that came right after these paintings are a little bit different, because I think every time I make a body of work, I mean, on some level, I'm trying really hard to be a conceptual artist.
Mm-hmm.
And so, like, you know, I would make a body of paintings, and then I would
make a switch.
Yeah, like, make something that was not necessarily just, like, more of that.
Mm-hmm.
So after this group of work, I started to make this other stuff that was a little bit faster and was a little bit more... it was a little bit less concerned about drawing. I was trying to actually build some of these structures with shape more than with line.
So, and I think we see that actually in You, which is the third.
Yeah, use the last. Use kind of the transitional
one
between these and the next.
What you're doing now.
Although You, I never really know if You. What You is, You is the last painting, and it was definitely the one that I just didn't know. And it could have easily turned into an entirely other painting and gone into a different show.
Uh-huh, exactly. That's how I felt about it, too.
Mm-hmm. It was kind of hovering.
Mm-hmm.
hovering on being a completely different painting.
Yeah, and there's certainly less line work in it and more your comfort or discomfort with having larger expanses of color, you know, real sections of bold.
But you know what I noticed? I was fine with the part on the right where the big expanses of color were.
Yeah.
And I was having a really hard time with the left. And people were always coming into my studio going, wow, this is a real big deal. You just have a color green. And I'd be like, huh, that?
Oh, like that was so radical.
Big deal. That's the part that I'm perfectly happy with.
Oh,
the part on the left is a mess.
But the part on the left is so much more what you'd been doing, so that's interesting.
Well, the part on the left was kind of hovering between being one of these linear architectonic structures and then just being this kind of salmon-colored doorway that you could either go in or out of. And I kind of could never decide between making it into a hardcore object-y thing like the one on the left of Behemoth, or whether to make it an ephemeral orange doorway, like sort of like
reference.
You know, like sort of like the
like
hole in
Eye.
So I never could really make you become one thing, and then I ended up deciding that ambivalence was sort of the subject, so I would just leave it in a kind of strange floating condition.
Mm-hmm. Right. Do you, because I know that we've felt really strongly that the small paintings are just as important as the big paintings.
Yeah, that's why we hung them that way.
Yeah, exactly. We wanted them to be hung together in this very straightforward way, so that they didn't get overpowered by the big paintings. I don't think that they can because they're so strong individually and collectively. But is there any way in which, when you're making the smaller works, do you work differently or is it the same process?
It's the same. It's just that you can turn them around more easily.
Right.
I mean, these weigh a lot. I actually put my back out moving the big paintings.
Yeah.
Like, I actually went to a physical therapist in the middle of this process.
I remember.
And she said, you have a rib out of place. Stop picking up heavy things.
And you're like, but I can't. Got into it.
Yeah.
But that was interesting, too, when during Ian and I, my visits to your studio many times in the course of doing the show, that sometimes you'd have the painting. I mean, I remember this with Behemoth, where you weren't even sure what was the top, and we were kind of rotating them in a quarter direction and kind of looking at them together and thinking,
well, we still
which
don't
way
know which way
go.
H.
Right,
we don't know which way H goes still.
Exactly.
You know, if anyone buys H and
they
like
turn
it better,
upside down.
Go ahead. I don't really care.
I mean, is that true of all of these, or they are sort of oriented
now,
in the final version for the most part?
Well, I think like there's something about painting in general where when eyes look at them, they change.
Mm-hmm.
And when, a friend of mine said that he didn't like paintings that had been looked at too much.
He felt like they somehow are effective.
Yeah, he said that they just get, they get stale or they get overworked.
Like Mona Lisa?
Well, maybe, but no, he meant like, you know,
by him.
In his studio, like he said that he had a critique of some painting, which was, oh, it's been looked at too much.
Interesting.
Which sort of scared me when he said that, because I thought, oh no, no.
Because I would think
I've looked at too much. Not looked at enough.
As viewers, you feel the opposite. Like you never get to look at anything long enough. And one thing that I really love about these is that, you know, I've been looking at these paintings
for a long time
with you.
Yeah.
And I'm always discovering new things. I mean, they're very generous in that way. And I'll surprise myself, like that I never noticed a particular color on a panel or a line or a relationship between something. And it's fun. They're very fun to look at. And I think you could spend a lot of time with them. If anything, that it's just, you know, how do you choose which one to stare at?
Yeah, I mean, in a way, I think that's exactly why we hung them this way, right? Because when these, which have a lot packed into them, when they were hung next to big ones, they seemed to diminish a little bit. And so we ended up putting all of them on one line pretty much because they then, I think, came forward as like complex objects in their own right.
Exactly.
And they didn't seem like lesser objects.
Flanking the big one.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because they're pretty packed.
Yeah.
These are pretty packed tight. That's what's different about the work that I started after this group of work that's in my studio. It's much opener.
Yeah.
It's much more, in fact, that same guy who's, I should say his name because I'm going to give him credit, but this friend of mine who's a painter, Joe Fife.
Uh-huh.
Joe was the one, he came to my studio at the end when I was kind of nervous about these before they went out. And I said, what do you think of these? And he said, I like the ones that you've done right after this because it looks like you let your foot off the gas a little. And I thought, oh, the new ones will not. And then I had other people come visit my studio and they said, these don't seem enough for me. I prefer this group that's
ones.
At that we're looking at. So taste, you know, determines that. But some people thought that these were a little too packed, and other people thought that these were sufficiently packed, and that the new looser ones were too loose, mm-hmm. too less, too little was there.
Right.
So I mean, you know, I don't really care one way or the other, but I think that these are definitely wound tight.
Right.
I think.
Yeah, I think so, too. Mm-hmm. Maybe it's because you're wound tight.
I was wound tight when I did them. Now I'm loose.
Now you're
I'm
loose.
Relaxed.
Now you're relaxed.
Very relaxed.
Is there anything else you want to say?
Thanks for giving me a show.
Oh, it's been so much fun.